I'd like to address a very simple question today, and that is there any value to a Jewish cultural identity? When we think of the fact that we are Jewish, it is because we are Jewish according to Jewish law, and we identify as being Jewish through mitzvah observance. We have a set of laws that we must study and observe, and when we do that, we identify as Jews through mitzvah observance. But what about other ways to identify as Jews? What if we eat Jewish food? And I don't mean kosher food, but Jewish food, bagel and lox. What if we identify as Jews through Jewish humor? What if we are culturally Jewish? Is there a value to being culturally Jewish, to act in a way that others will perceive us as Jewish, but not in terms of mitzvos? I think that this is an important question, and I think that the Pesach story, as understood by Chazal, our sages, can be helpful in addressing this very important question. Now, let me begin by asking the following question. Did the Bnei Yisrael believe in God in Egypt before Moshe appeared on the scene, or were they idolaters? And even after Moshe appeared, were they idolaters or faithful to God? Now, if you simply read the Chumash, you get the impression that the Bnei Yisrael believed in God. There doesn't seem to be any textual evidence that they worshipped idols. And when Paro dies in Shmos Perek Beis, Psukim Chav Gimel and Chav Daled, the Torah tells us that the Bnei Yisrael cried. Torah says, "Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min avodah, vayizaku." They cried, they moaned, they cried. "Vatal shavasam el ho'elokim," and their cries rose up to God. Now, you could argue that they didn't specifically cry to God; they just cried in general, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu heard their cries. However, in Parshas Chukas and Parshas Kisavo, when recalling their sojourn in Egypt, the Bnei Israel say, "Vanitzak el Hashem," both in Parshas Chukas, Perchav, Pasuk Tezayin, and in Parshas Kisavo, Perchav, Pasuk Zayin, "Vanitzak el Hashem el Kehavoseinu." So if you only read the Chumash, you would think that the Bnei Israel believed in monotheism and cried out to God and did not worship idolatry in Egypt. However, Sefer Yecheskel describes another reality. In Parak Chaf, when recalling the story of Egypt, God tells them, "Ishikutze einav hashlichu, uvgilulei Mitzrayim al titamo, ani Hashem Elokeichem." God told them to cast away their detestable things to which they are drawn, meaning their idols. But the pasuk says in Parak Chaf in Yecheskel pasuk Ches, "Ve'amru bi ve'lo avu lishmo elai." They didn't listen. They didn't leave their idolatry. And then God said he wanted to destroy the Bnei Israel, to pour out his wrath and wipe them out. But in Pasuk Tes, God did not, at the end of the day, destroy the Bnei Israel, but because he saved them, for his own name's sake, for God's sake, that God did not want his name to be profaned by the other nations, to say that God could not take them out of Egypt. So we have a conflict between the Chumash, which indicates that the Bnei Yisrael were righteous, versus Yecheskel, which indicates that the Bnei Yisrael were idolatrous and potentially worthy of being destroyed. And there are different ways to solve this problem. Now, one approach to solve this problem is to say that yes, they were idolaters. This is the position of the Midrash in Shir HaShirim. The Midrash in Shir HaShirim, Rabbah, Parsha Beis, in Parsha Beis, the Midrash tells us that we were like a Shoshana Bein HaChochim. This is the Shir HaShirim says, we were like a rose between the thorns that are kasha lebala lehilakei. It's difficult to pluck the rose from the thorns. Kaka ulasan shal Yisrael haishta kasha lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So too, the redemption of Klal Yisrael was difficult before God. And the Medrash cites the pasuk that Hashem took a goy mikerev goy. And we don't say that Hashem took a goy mikerev am or an am mikerev goy. It says that Hashem took a goy mikerev goy. Why? Because we were just like, we were a goy, and they were a goy. We were just like the Egyptians. Shehoyu Elu Arelim Ve'elu Arelim. That both the Bnei Israel and the Egyptians were uncircumcised. Elu Megalim Blores Ve'elu Megalim Blores. Elu Lov Shek Kilayim Ve'elu Lov Shek Kilayim. Both of them had an idolatrous hairstyle. Both of them wore Kilayim. And Kaddish, then the Medrash continues and says that the Midas Adin didn't want Bnei Israel to be freed. And Ilulei Shemar Kadosh Baruch Hu Atzmo Bishvua Lo Yisrael Nigalim Lalam. Had God not made the oath that He made in Shmos Perek Vav, Lochein Emor Livnei Yisrael Ni Hashem Votseisi Etzchem Mitachas Sivlos Mitzrayim, that if not for that, that God made a shvua, a promise, an oath that He would take the Bnei Yisrael out of Egypt, He wouldn't have let them out because they were just like the Egyptians. And the Rambam takes a similar position. The Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Gimel, explains that Yaakov taught monotheism to his children, and he appointed Shevet Levi as the teachers of the way of God. And in the exile in Egypt, the Rambam writes, Acha Orcho Yom Nisob Mitzrayim V'chazur Luma Maseim V'lava Kochavim Kamosam, that with the passage of time, that Yaakov's descendants began to worship the stars just like the Egyptians, chus mi Shevet Levi, except for the tribe of Levi, she'amad b'mitzvos avos. Shevet Levi remained faithful to God. And the Rambam believes that God only freed us also because of the promise that He made to Avram Avinu. Now perhaps, if that's true, could be that Yecheskel, Sefer Yecheskel, reflects the reality, but maybe the Torah did not want to highlight the Bnei Yisrael's lowly spiritual state so as not to detract from the focus of God's miracles and the Egyptians being deserving of punishment. Now, another approach to solve this problem is to say that in reality, the Bnei Yisrael believed in one God. This is the position of the Rad and Rav Chasdai Kreskes cited in the Abravanel in Sefer Bereishis, Perek Tesvav, the 15th question. According to the Abravanel, he cites that both the Rad and Rav Chasdai Kreskes, that the exile in Egypt were not based on any sin that the Bnei Israel, that the Bnei Israel did not commit any sin, and the common denominator of both of these two Mefarshim is that the Golus Mitzrayim, the exile, was a chesed, was an act of kindness to Klal Yisrael, and was not a punishment on any sin whatsoever, because the Bnei Yisrael did not commit a sin. They were righteous. Now, for purposes of this Darasha, I'm most interested in a third approach to solve this problem. First approach, again, that they worshipped idolatry, and God freed them because, even though they weren't deserving, either because this is God's plan. Second approach is they really were righteous. Maybe there was a small number of people who worshipped idolatry, and maybe that's what Sefer Yecheskel is pointing to. But the third approach expresses the idea that perhaps they were idolaters, but they also had some redeeming qualities. The Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael tells us that according to Blitzer HaKapor, the Bnei Israel had four mitzvos that made them distinct and that provided perhaps the reason for them, for their redemption. The first was Shelo Nechshadu Al Harayos. They were not suspect of illicit sexual relations. Lo Al Lashon Hara, not of slander. Lo Shino Shemam, they didn't change their names. And Lo Shino Shlishonam, they didn't change their language. And the Milchilta brings a proof text for each of these positions. How do you know they weren't nechshdu al harayos? They weren't suspected of illicit relationships? Because the pasuk says in Parshas Emor, Vayetzi ben isha Yisraelis, there was one time when there was a woman, there's a story about a son of a Hebrew woman. He was the union, the result, the offspring of a relationship between an Israelite woman and an Egyptian man. And the fact this is the only time that the Torah mentions this is Lodia Shivchan Shal Yisrael Shalom Beneam Elazeb. This was the only time that a Hebrew had an illicit relation with an Egyptian. And so this is the exception which proves the rule that generally they did not engage in Arayos, forbidden illicit relationships. How do you know they weren't suspect on Lashon Hara? And there it's because they knew that they were going to take the wealth from the Egyptians for 12 months during the plagues. Before the plague started, Hashem tells Moshe the burning bush, V'shal isha mishchanta, klei kesef, klei zahav, that they're going to borrow gold and silver. And Bnei Israel did not say anything. And they were quiet. So they didn't tell Lashon Hara and their friends. They didn't tell anyone about this plan. How do you know they didn't change their names? Because just like they had their names of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi when they went down to Egypt and Sefer Shmos, Perikov, Pasuk Bey, so too when they left, the Torah says in Bamidbar, Vayisiyado Mishpechosam Levesavosam, that they considered, they were registered by their clans according to their ancestral houses of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, etc. And how do you know they didn't change their language? Because they refer to themselves as the God of the Ivrim, Elokei HaIvrim Nikra Aleinu. So they're called Ivrim. So the Medrash here assumes that they had these four redeeming qualities of not being suspect of illicit relations, slander, changing their names, and changing their language. And at the end of this Medrash, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseir Omer, Harehu Omer, Velo Shomel Moshe Mikotzer Ruach. After Moshe had told them the great promise of Otsesi Vitzalti Vigalti Vikachli, the Torah tells us they didn't listen to Moshe because of their shortness of breath. And so the Medrash asks, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseir asks, V'chi yishalcha adam shehu mitzbaser besara tova v'eino sameach? No lecha ben zachor rabcha motziach lecheres v'eino sameach? If someone tells you great news, you're going to have a child, you're going to be taken out to freedom, and you're not going to be happy. So in Kain Lama Nemar v'lo shema l'moshe, so why does the Torah say they don't listen to Moshe when they hear this great news? It was difficult for them to separate themselves from Avodah Zarah, and the Medrash cites the pasuk in Yechezkel. So, according to the Mechilta, the Bnei Yisrael had four characteristics: maintaining sexual purity, refraining from talebearing, preserving Hebrew names, and preserving Hebrew language, even though they were idolaters. And the truth is, there are variations on this exact list of redeeming qualities. There's a great article by Rabbi Eli Fisher listing all the different variations. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says they had three redeeming qualities. It says, Shelo hechlifu lishonam, v'lo haya b'neim lashon hara, uveyichud Hashem. They did not change their language, they didn't inform one another, and through unification of God's name. Now the truth is, Professor Saul Lieberman believes that the phrase Yichud Hashem is actually a mistake, and the correct tech, because in Sefer Yechezkel it says Ish Shikutzeinav, that the Mitzrayim, that they kept the abominations of Egypt. It says according to Yechezkel that they were idolatrous, so it can't mean that they believe in Yichud Hashem. So therefore he thought it was a misprint and shouldn't say Yichud Hashem but Yichus Hashem, meaning what? They didn't change their names, which is exactly what the Mechilta says. The Tanit Ve'eliyahu has a different list of redeeming qualities, that the Bnei Yisrael made a pact that they would be kind to each other. They Yasu Gimilus Chasadim Zeimzeh. V'yishmu Bilvavam Bris Avram Yisrael Yaakov. They would preserve the covenant of Avram Yisrael and Yaakov. And they would not abandon Shelo Yanichu Lashon Beis Yaakov Aviha, that they would not abandon the language of their ancestors. This may be more of a moral religious code. But that medrash is the exception, not the rule, in discussing their redeeming qualities. The Psikta Zutrata in one place lists four redeeming qualities. Lo Shidu Esh L'Shodam, Lo Chilfu Sim Losam, Lo Gilu Sodam, and Lo Batlu Bris Mila. They didn't change their dress, they didn't reveal their secrets, and they didn't neglect Bris Mila. And they did not change their clothing. And another place that Psikta Zutrata says, Shahaya Malbusham, is in Devarim, Daf Memvav, Amud Aleph, Shahaya Malbusham, Umachalam Lashonam, Mishunamina Mitzriim, that their clothing and their food and their language was different than the Egyptians. And the Midrash and Midrash Rabbah says that they had four redeeming qualities, that they didn't change their names and their dress, they didn't reveal their secrets, and they weren't promiscuous. Now what's interesting is that some of these behaviors reflect moral values, like not being promiscuous. But some of these behaviors of not changing names, dress, or language reflect not moral but cultural values. Even though they may have worshipped idolatry, they remained culturally Jewish. Now, is there a value to simply being culturally Jewish? Well, in the 19th and 20th centuries, great rabbis debated this very point. At some point between 1805 and 1808, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Torem of Rimenov delivered a drasha when he railed against the adoption of Gentile modes of dress. He cited a medrash that Bnei Israel did not change their names, language, or dress in Egypt. He says the following: even though each of them owned 90 loaded donkeys, they nevertheless contented themselves with one garment. And they did not, and this is referring to the Bnei Israel in the desert, and they did not seek new styles of clothing, as is the custom of the world nowadays when each day is different from the next. And then he cites this medrash: they didn't change their name, their language, or their dress. Now, other rabbinic leaders followed suit, including the Chassam Sofer. Now, the Chassam Sofer was somewhat, in fighting the Reform movement, made the famous declaration of Chadash Asar Min HaTorah. Any innovation, even if it's not necessarily anti-halachic, is forbidden from the Torah, because he was very concerned of assimilation. And in his Haggadah, he writes, on the comment on the verse that says, Vehisham L'goy Gadol Malamin Shal Yitzurah Mitzuyin M'sham, that the Bnei Yisrael were a distinct nation, Yadua ki hayu mitsuyanim ayde shloshinu shmam ulishonam umabusham, that they were distinct, that they didn't change their names, their language, and their dress. And in his ethical will, he warns his descendants not to change. He says, Hizaru, be careful, mishinu hashem, from changing your name, vilashon, or your language, umabush, nachrim, from having foreign names, language, or dress. V'siman, and what's the sign for that? What's the acrostic? V'yavo Yaakov Shalem. We have to be Shalem, standing Shin for Shem, Lamed for Lashon, and Mem for Mabush. We need to have a distinct name, language, and dress. Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, a rabbinical leader in Pressburg and student of Chassam Sofer, went one step further, and he said the following. He said, Shame, Lashon, and Malbush, name, language, and dress, Asher Hamidu, Bnei Yisrael, Avoseinu B'Mitzrayim, that our ancestors established themselves, who sustained their ancestors in Egypt, Asher Bishchusam Nigalu V'Hem Achrim Neged, and through their merit they were redeemed, Hem Machrim Neged Kol Mitzvot Shebat Torah, they outweigh all the mitzvot in the Torah. If these, God forbid, will be taken away from Klal Yisrael, as kol mitzvos heim rak kilavush below guf, then all the mitzvos would simply be like clothing without a body. Keila hadvarim heim guf Yisrael. These things are like the body of the Jew. Va'yidehem hoyinulam, and through them we became a nation. In other words, Rav Schlesinger asserts that distinctive names, language, and dress outweigh all of the mitzvos because they are like the body of the Jew. Now that's obviously a very extreme position regarding the importance of distinctive dress, names, and language. On the other hand, there were some 19th century scholars who rejected this notion that the Midrash even said such a thing. For example, Shlomo Buber, who is the grandfather of Martin Buber, he was an expert in Midrashim, and he said the following. He says that in the Mechilta, it says Lo Nechshedu Al Harayos. It says that they were not suspecting; they're not suspicious of Arayos, and Velo Sipu Lashon Hara. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. Velo Shidu Eshbab, and they didn't change their name. He says that's the medrash, and loshonam. So there's no arayos, no loshon hara, no name change, no language change. Aval mamar shog refi rabim, but the passage that said that the masses say veloshinu es malbu sham, that they didn't change their clothing, ein zecher mimenu b'shum makom. There's no mention of that anywhere, and he thinks that that is a mistake. Now, if we fast forward about 100 years, in 1980, Rav Moshe Feinstein addressed the question of naming Jewish children after deceased relatives who had foreign names. And he writes this tshuva in Or HaChaim Chilek Dalet Siman Samach Vav. And Rav Moshe Feinstein brought halachic sources to rule leniently, and then he addressed the medrash of the Bnei Yisrael being distinctive for not changing their names, language, and dress. He says that Hine Yesh Makom Lomar, you could argue, Dezeh Sheshimcho Chazal Begolos Mitzrayim Shloshino Shmo Es Shmosam, that which Chazal praised the Jewish people that they didn't change their names, who Kodem Matan Torah. That's only before Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Because at that point, Lo Haya Heker Gadol Bishvil Kima Mitzvos. There wasn't a great distinction, no obvious difference in terms of the observance of the mitzvos. And Rav Moshe says that, yeah, before Matan Torah, so then we didn't have mitzvos, so then it was important to have these external expressions of a distinction between being a Jew and a non-Jew. And then he writes, Aval Achar Matan Torah, after the giving of the Torah, Ein Lanu Chiyav Midina, we have no formal obligation. V'gam lo mi'inyanei zehirus u'musar, nor is it a matter of morality and piety, elamash nitzaveinu atayag mitzvos ledoros. What do we have to follow? What the mitzvos, what we're commanded to do, and the mitzvos that are l'shah, and the mitzvos Torah Shabbat Peh, but we don't find that Chazal talk about some act of piety of having different names and language and clothing. So Moshe Feinstein believes that the external markers of identity are important only when there is no more substantive means of distinguishing one's identity. Before Matan Torah, the only means you had to distinguish yourself from the outside world was your cultural identity, your name, dress, and language. However, after Matan Torah, we have the mitzvos to distinguish us from the outside world, so there is no need for markers of distinctiveness. And I wonder, how should we view these marks of distinctiveness? What I would refer to as marks defining our cultural identity. Is Rav Moshe Feinstein absolutely correct? Or is there any value to distinctive dress, names, and language post-Matan Torah? So I think on one level, there is a universalistic goal of showcasing our differences, of expressing a cultural identity for all to see, irrespective of what the cultural identity is. Rabbi Sachs, in his book, The Dignity of Difference, on page 46, he writes that some people think that religion is a danger because religion is identity, and identity excludes. And we think that identity can cause fragmentation and fighting. However, he argues that universalism has its challenges as well. He writes that it leads to the belief, superficially compelling but quite false, that there is only one truth about the essentials of the human condition, and it holds true for all people at all times. If I am right, you are wrong. If what I believe is the truth, then your belief, which differs from mine, must be an error from which you must be converted, cured, and saved. From this flowed some of the great crimes of history, some under religious auspices, others, the French and Russian revolutions, for example, under the banner of secular philosophies. Therefore, Rabbi Sachs writes that God, the creator of humanity, having made a covenant with all humanity, then turns to one people and commands it to be different, teaching humanity to make space for difference. When we wear our Jewish identity with pride, we teach the world the value of difference, the value of respecting others, the value in appreciating diversity. We don't hide our religious differences in the privacy of our own homes or in the privacy of our synagogues, but we express our differences publicly with pride. According to Rabbi Sachs, the Pesach story teaches the world the value of particularism, of religion, of distinctiveness as a method of tolerance. The Pesach story tells a story when God told Egypt, the superpower of the world, do not dominate over another society just because they are different. In the Pesach story, our differences became a source of pride, and we should celebrate our differences and not be in fear of our differences, afraid of expressing ourselves for fear of getting canceled. The universalistic message of publicly expressing our unique cultural identity teaches us the value of tolerance for differences that exist all around us. But the Pesach story teaches us more than the value of tolerance stemming from cultural identity. The Pesach story teaches us about the value of cultural identity, both to those of us who may not be halachically observant and to those of us who are halachically observant. First, is there any value to those bagel and lox Jews, to Jews who identify as Jews with Jewish names or who may celebrate Jewish holidays in whatever way is meaningful to them, but they are not Torah observant? Let us talk a bit about the Rush of the wicked son. His siblings are all described through intellectual categories. Wise, simple, doesn't know how to ask. However, the Rasha is stamped with an ethical or moral or religious category. What is the wickedness of this child? The Haggadah tells us that the wicked son says, Maha avodah zos lachem. What is this ritual service that you are performing? The Rasha sees no part for himself in the religious practices or values of his parents, and yet he is sitting at the Seder table. 65 years ago, the Lubavitcher Rebbe reframed the core purpose of the Seder to find and invite the fifth son, any Jewish man or woman who is absent from the Seder. The fifth son is completely assimilated. He is completely unconnected to any Jewish roots. But even the Rasha is at the Seder table. What kind of person is the Rasha who sits at the Seder table? And why is he sitting? And while he is sitting at the Seder table, he is motzi es atzmo min haklal, and he's kofer be'ikar. Who is this individual? He is someone who separates himself from our Torah values. He is someone who rejects fundamental principles of faith, and yet he sits at the Seder table. He is someone without Torah and mitzvos, but he culturally identifies as a Jew. And we give him mussar. We tell him that without Torah and mitzvos, he would not have been redeemed. We tell him that Torah and mitzvos are the key to our community. But we still can have a conversation with the Rasha because he is culturally affiliated. Now, let me be clear. There are perhaps culturally affiliated Jews who are also Tams and who are also different levels. But I think the point of the four sons and the Rasha specifically is that even if someone is completely bereft of Torah and mitzvos, but he still is culturally affiliated, there's what to work with him. It's not going to be easy because he challenges us every step of the way, but he's sitting at the table. He's part of the community. You see, there's a difference between someone who's a mumar and someone who's even a rasha. Someone who is a mumar who converted to Christianity, who not only rejected the mitzvahs of Judaism, but culturally rejected Jewish identity and converted to Christianity, can return to Judaism. But the Rama writes in Yoredeya, Simon Reish Samaches, Seif Yud Beis, that this individual who converts to Christianity must immerse himself in a mikvah, even though it's a rabbinic requirement. We believe that a Jew who converts to Christianity, halachli, is still a Jew, Yisrael afapi shechata Yisrael hu. But once he rejects his Jewish identity in favor of another identity, he needs to be a born-again Jew, as it were, through the process of immersion, albeit on a rabbinic level. Even a Rasha, even a Jew who rejects all Jewish religious practices, can still sit with us at the Seder table. And he is not completely removed. That would necessitate immersion if he returns to Jewish practice. Merely identifying as a Jew on a cultural level still allows him to be part of our community. And maybe that's precisely what the story of Pesach is teaching us. We were only culturally distinctive, but we were idolatrous just like the Egyptians. Nevertheless, God still had faith in us and provided us with the opportunity to strengthen our faith through the Makos. And maybe the story of Pesach teaches us not to give up on Jews who only express cultural identity and not religious identity, as painfully as it may be for us to see them that way, as long as they come to the Seder table. Even as far removed as they may be from halachic observance, there is a place for them. There is a value to cultural identity because it creates some connection and it gives us an opening to reconnect this individual with his or her roots. But what about for us who are Torah observant, who keep mitzvos? For us, Is there a value of cultural Jewish identity if we already have a Jewish identity by virtue of us observing Torah and mitzvos? Maybe Rav Moshe Feinstein is correct, that we are not halachically obligated to have unique dress, names, and language. But Rav Moshe Feinstein is also famous for saying something else. He said that the single Yiddish expression, which encapsulates the demise of the Jewish values of first-generation American Jews, was, es ist schwer zu sein a Yid, or it's difficult to be a Jew. Maybe we are technically obligated. Maybe we are not technically obligated to have a unique dress, to have a unique names, to have a unique language, but we are absolutely obligated to have what these outward expressions of cultural identity represent, and that is Jewish pride. A rejection of, es ist schwer zu sein a Yid. We must observe Torah and mitzvahs out of a sense of obligation, but we must absolutely also observe Torah and mitzvahs from a sense of Jewish pride, and here's why. In the beginning of the 19th century, when the Jewish reform movement took root, the first reformers were laymen working with rabbinic leadership, and their concern was membership. A high percentage of Jews were converting to Christianity, many feeling that Judaism was archaic and outdated. So the reforms were aimed at updating Judaism in the age of emancipation and Western standards of aesthetics and decorum to make Judaism more attractive. The initial reforms included abbreviating the liturgy, introducing the sermon in the vernacular, choral singing with an organ accompaniment, and supplementing the standard Hebrew prayers with prayer in the vernacular. There is a constitution of the Hamburg Temple, dated December 11th in 1817, which states, since public worship has for some time been neglected by so many because of the ever-decreasing knowledge of the language in which alone it has until now been conducted, because of many of the other shortcomings which have been crept in at the time, the undersigned, convinced of the necessity to restore public worship to its deserving dignity and importance, have joined together to follow the example of several Israelite congregations, especially the one in Berlin. Specifically, there shall be introduced at such services a German sermon and choral singing to the accompaniment of an organ. As we know, these reforms, the first which were merely cultural but may not have been strict halachic violation, represented the first step in what became a series of halachic violations in the reform movement. But the first step was eliminating elements of cultural identity, because these Jews were embarrassed of Jewish practice. Lack of pride ultimately can lead to a lack of observance. And this is what caused the start of the reform movement. Even today, as David Suisa has remarked, many Jews are embarrassed of Jews and Judaism. Listen to what he writes in the Jewish Journal, dated December 23rd, 2021, in an article, "There is no Jewish future without Jewish pride." He writes the following: "I have Jewish friends in academia who frown at the idea of saying, 'I'm a proud Jew.' They see pride as something simplistic and unsophisticated, what a tribal Jew might express at a rally. Also, in their view, Jewish pride depends on Jewish action. If they're passionate about repairing the world, for example, this makes them proud of that action, that Jewish action. But when Jews do something very wrong, this makes them feel the very opposite of pride, more like shame. It's similar with Israel. As long as they see Israel as oppressing the Palestinians, they can never bring themselves to express Zionist pride. They may be pro-Israel, but they too see many problems to express, too many problems to ever express pride. With so much repairing of Israel to do, what Israel needs is rebuke, engagement, protest. Those are useful action-oriented sentiments. Pride, on the other hand, feels like an empty indulgence. Who can think of pride when there's so much to fix, so much to be ashamed of? This cold, conditional mindset has been deadly to the health of American Judaism. Its deadliness, however, has been well camouflaged as it comes under the guise of that noble Jewish value of self-criticism. Self-criticism is indeed noble, but when it becomes a fetish or a reflexive dogma, it can suffocate the visceral bonds that are essential to the lifeblood of a community or a relationship. Take the love of a parent for a child. More often than not, it's unconditional. The child may make plenty of mistakes, but that doesn't stop a parent from expressing their unconditional love. That unconditional aspect is crucial to the health of the relationship. Jews who instinctively express Jewish pride fall into that category. There may be things that Israel does or that Jews do that they cannot stand, and they will express their rebukes. But none of that stops them from expressing their Jewish pride. That pride is rooted not in the transient winds of the moment, but in the timeless echoes of the past. I'm a proud Jew not because Israel did something great yesterday, or because a Jewish organization did something cool last week, or because I just read an inspirational sermon. I'm a proud Jew because I belong to an extraordinary people with a tradition that has sustained us for thousands of years. It is that very existence, that sense of belonging to something remarkable, that is the deepest source of my unconditional pride. David Suisa correctly points out that many Jews who are embarrassed of Jews and Judaism say they have Jewish pride, but they're constantly critical of Israel, of how some Jews behave, whether they are not supportive enough of Israel, whether they belong to a particular political party, whether they are not sufficiently open-minded, or whether they are too open-minded. There is plenty to criticize, and that's all that we hear often. But we don't hear enough pride. We don't hear enough Jewish pride simply by virtue of the fact that I belong to an extraordinary people with a tradition that has sustained us for thousands of years. I think that expressing our cultural identity, reflecting Jewish pride, impacts how we live our lives as Jews on a daily basis. It is not enough for us to observe mitzvot as a servant does for a king. But we need the pride. We need to infuse our observance with pride. You know why some Orthodox Jews walk around with a spring in their step, always looking to learn more, to do more, to develop their connection to their roots on an even deeper level? While others are content to do what they've always done and simply check the halakhic boxes each and every day? It's all about Jewish pride. If you have Jewish pride, if you're excited about what it means to be a Jew, then you want to do more and more and more. For those with real Jewish pride, halacha is not the ceiling, but it's the floor. You see, Shavuos is not about Jewish pride, it's about the law. Shavuos is the time to celebrate receiving the Torah. Shavuos is about feeling the weight of the Torah being lifted over our heads, like when God lifted the mountain over our heads at Sinai, Kafa Aleihem Har Kegigis. And don't get me wrong, I think we need to feel forced on some level. We need to feel on a very basic level that we are servants, obeying a king. We need to feel that sense of obligation during those times when we just don't feel like doing the mitzvos, when we're not in the mood. You see, that's what Shavuos is for. But Pesach is about Jewish pride. Pesach tells a story of how God lovingly embraced us and selected us and took us in to be his chosen nation. The truth is that it wasn't so clear what the Seder would actually look like after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. On the one hand, the Mishnah tells us in Psachim, Perek Yud, Mishnah Dal and Mishnah He, that after the child asks the questions on the night of the Seder, we tell him the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We are Doresh from Arami Oved Avi until the end of the section. We expound upon the biblical verses in Parshas Kisavo, which tell our story, that we were slaves and we suffered and we cried out to God and we were freed. This description of what we are supposed to do at the Seder, of telling our story, is one of pride. But our Haggadah also cites the Mechilta, which states that when the Chacham asked his question, we teach him Halacha. Af ata emor lo kehilchos ha-Pesach, ein maftirin achara Pesach afikomen. And the goal on the Seder night is not about some great story about which we should celebrate, but it's about all the halachic details of the night up until the very end, until the Afikomen. And this source suggests that maybe there is some debate as to what the Pesach Seder should look like. Is it a night of halachic analysis? Or is it a night when we relive our story? And I know what you're thinking. Sure, when the kids are awake, we put on a production, we sing and we spend money on buying Mako's finger puppets and other Pesach props because we want our children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews, the little ones, to feel pride, to get excited. We put on a Seder show for them. But what about us? Do we care to get excited? Is our Seder production only about little children? But once the children go to sleep, the singing is over, the finger puppets are put away, the excitement and passion are gone. Are we only trying to inspire little children, but we are uninterested in inspiring ourselves with Jewish pride? Well, The Tosefta tells a story about what the rabbis did after the children fell asleep. They studied halacha all night long. But that story didn't win out. The story that won out, the story that is in our Haggadah, is not the story in the Tosefta with Rabban Gamliel and his colleagues who studied halacha all night long. The story that's in the Haggadah is the story of the rabbis who played with the finger puppets all night long, who kept on getting more and more excited, telling over the story long after the kids went to sleep. And these rabbis knew the story, but they retold the story, not solely from an intellectual perspective, but from an emotional perspective. After all, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, one of the members of the group, probably finished his meal by midnight, as was his ruling. And even after the meal, even after the Shulchan Aruch, and the Afikoman and the benching, he and the other rabbis continue with the next part of the Seder, which is Hallel, singing the praises of God all night until their students tell them it's time to recite Kriyat Shema in the morning. In our Haggadah, we don't tell the story of Rabban Gamliel and his group in Lod, who studied Halacha, when the Seder night was a Beis Medrash. We tell the story of the five rabbis in Bnei Brak, when Seder night was designed as a night of Hallel, a night of beaming Jewish pride. In Egypt, our ancestors may have been idolaters, but it seems that at the very least they kept a distinct cultural identity. And while we may argue, like Ramosha Feinstein, that after we received the Torah, a distinct cultural identity expressed by distinctive clothing, language, and names is unnecessary, I would argue that the value underlying cultural identity reflects Jewish pride, which is something that is so critical for each and every one of us. It is critical so that we learn the value of difference and of tolerating that difference in others, in being a bit humbler and not think that I own the truth. It is critical so that we accept and not simply give up on those Jews who only have a Jewish cultural identity but may not be observant, just as God lovingly accepted us when we were like that in Egypt. And it is critical so that we walk around with real, authentic Jewish pride, and that we express that pride, not just for little children so that they get excited. We don't just sing a Shabbos Zemer when young children are around and then stop when they are not around. Pesach tells us to emulate the five rabbis in Bnei Brak and to live a life of cultural identity, of Jewish pride. Pesach tells the men that we go to work wearing a yarmulke proudly as a Jew and not be afraid. This may mean that they are now going to scrutinize my behavior because I'm wearing a yarmulke. Pesach tells us that when we daven, we are proud that we have this amazing opportunity to connect with God, not simply check the boxes and say, I've davened. And Pesach tells us to embrace the community, our narrow community and our broader community. Because even though we have the option of only focusing on the negative, what this one did and what that one did, our dominant focus is on our incredible story, how we are an extraordinary people with a tradition that has sustained us for thousands of years. And my bracha to each and every one of us, that we have a beautiful Pesach, we think about our story, we relive our story, and we all emerge from this beautiful holiday beaming with more and more Jewish pride than ever before.